And now Iowa Contemporary Art presents Icon Art Radio.
This is Icon Art Radio with myself, Bill Teeple, and Donna Colby, and Alan Cobb. We are the three hosts, but today we're going to be interviewing one of the hosts, Alan Cobb, who is going to be doing part two of his discussion about the sound presentation he will make at Icon Gallery on October 18th, and then 2 weeks later on November 1st. Donna, you had something that you wanted to ask.
Yes, this was a question that is an extension of last week. You were talking about how we are immersed in an ocean of sounds all the time, and there's some kind of editing process that goes on when we hear one specific thing out of all of this ocean. And so I'm curious about how that editing process works, because I myself seem to have difficulty filtering as efficiently as I should. In other words, if I'm watching an interview on television where somebody is speaking one language and they make that soft and somebody else is saying it in English on top of that, or in French or whatever, mm-hmm. It's very hard for me to tune in to one or the other. I hear them blended together like chords.
Yes.
And the same thing if I'm talking to the telephone in a cafe. I'm hearing all of the sounds blended together, and it's hard for me to isolate the sound of the telephone call. I have to go plug my ear or go out into the hallway or something. And other people seem to not have that difficulty.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you know about that?
Well, there are a couple of things going on. First of all, and the most important factor is attention. It has to do with a kind of spontaneous area of attention. But if the person speaking on the phone, let's just assume that it is loud enough to be intelligible, and that they're not speaking too fast or it's a bad connection. Generally speaking, if what they're saying is captivating, then once you're captivated, you won't have much trouble isolating the voice from the room full of the restaurant. If what they're saying is not captivating and you want to put your attention on it, you may not have enough control over your attention, because after all, attention goes wherever it likes. So if the room is full of sounds that are potentially interesting and potentially relevant or even potentially dangerous or something, or if you're, for example, trying to also wait for your name to be called because your order is up, that will all interfere with the attention being able to settle in on one sound or another. Another factor that's very, very significant in this is the spatial component of it. Now, the fact that one ear is in the phone and the other ear is in the restaurant means that it should be easier, and is, I'm sure, easier than it would be if you were hearing the phone in both ears the same, to the same degree. Mm. But it's still, you know, it's going to vary from situation to situation and from person to person. If you make a recording of a room full of people all talking at once, and make a standard mono or stereo recording of that, and play it back on headphones so that you're kind of in the room again, you'll find that it's very difficult to zoom in on one conversation. Mm. Even though when you were in the restaurant having a conversation with someone, it wasn't all that difficult. And the question is, why is it more difficult listening to a recording that supposedly faithfully reproduces the restaurant sound? And the answer is that it's not faithfully reproducing the spatiality of the restaurant sound. The restaurant voices are all coming to you from different distances and locations and angles around the room. And the one that you're homing in on is coming from a very specific location, so it has certain phase characteristics. It's the sound from that person gets to your right ear and your left ear at a slightly different time, and that time differential tells the brain where that speaker is located in space. And if you make a binaural recording of this room, a similar to a stereo recording, but done with microphones that are in the ear canals of a dummy head, a sculpture of a head with holes and ear flaps and everything in the right places, and then little micro in each hole. Those little microphones will record pretty much what your eardrums were getting. And when you play that back on headphones, it produces a startlingly realistic 3D sound environment.
Even if you're playing it through the same speakers, let's say, as the first recording,
the same
that
headphones,
was recorded
yes,
differently.
The same headphones as the original recording. Yeah.
And when your attention can move.
So then
in
you can pick out individual conversations.
So I could decide I was going to listen to this in the,
yes,
or listen to that.
If you have a binaural recording of the cocktail party, you could play it back four times on headphones and listen to a different conversation each time.
Absolutely fascinating. And you yourself, I know, having seen your studio, do things like this with
yes,
microphones,
yeah,
placing them in a mock head or...
Yeah, or sticking them in my own ears.
Right.
Yeah. No, binaural recording, my first experience with it was just utterly shocking. I mean, it made my hair stand on end. My wife was sitting in the bedroom, you know, reading a book or something, and I had just gotten a very, very high-quality portable recorder, and I decided to do a binaural experiment, and I went out and got a couple of really cheap Sony tie-clip mics, kind of like the ones we're using right now, only much cheaper, and I got them at Radio Shack or something, and I bent the springs a little bit so they wouldn't hurt, and I clipped them onto my earlobes like earrings. And I walked into the bedroom, and Mary said a few things, and there was a TV going at on the other side of the room, and it was saying a few things. And then I stopped the recording and went over and sat down on the bed near Mary and played back the recording. And I was listening to it through earbuds, just the ones that sort of sit loosely in your ears. So I could still hear the room and everything, you know, it wasn't like I was sealed inside headphones. And I played it back, and at first I heard nothing. And then Mary said something. And I looked up because she said it on my right. But I had turned around when I sat on the bed, and to my right was a blank wall. And there was no one there. And I knew in my mind's eye that she was there speaking to me. And when I turned and didn't see anyone, I was startled. I mean, I thought, whoa, something funny is going on here. And then I heard the TV, and it was coming from the wrong side of the room. And it was so real that I sort of turned the other way in surprise, you know, expecting to see Mary standing there holding the TV set or something, and it was still where it was supposed to be. It just happened that it was not making much noise, and the recording was, you know, was speaking instead. And that amount of realism was really surprising. It wasn't just, it sounds like it's on the right. It was, I know exactly where that voice is coming from, and it isn't. There's nothing there. It's all coming from the little earbuds. Mm. So that got me fascinated by binaural recording. I started looking for binaural records and doing more experimental recordings myself. And now I've found tools that I can use to create binaural recordings artificially, based on a system called a convolution processor, which is probably a lot like what the brain does. And so I can make a recording of a synthesizer that's never actually been played in air. It's just a completely synthetic waveform on the computer. And then I can place that a little bit to the right of center and a little bit above the horizon in a recording. And then I can take another synthesized sound and place that to the left, but farther to the left and a little bit below the horizon. And I can take six or eight sounds and put each one in a specific location. And when you play that back on headphones, you hear where this sound is coming from.
So when you're giving this presentation at Odd Thursday, are you going to have anything? Does it require headphones to experience this?
The binaural effect does, because if you play it back through speakers, then both ears hear both speakers.
Oh, right.
And the binaural recording is really using the stereo machinery to capture just what the left ear hears on one track and just what the right ear hears on the other track. But you can still demonstrate binaural spatial perception with speakers, just by showing how the time difference, which is how binaural works largely, the time difference between the two speakers determines where the sound is coming from. We normally think of you know, anyone who's done any recording at home is aware of the balance control, which turns up the right speaker and turns down the left speaker, or vice versa. And whichever speaker is louder, that seems to be where the sound is coming from. And if the right speaker is on exclusively, then you think it's coming all the way from the right. But that's not actually how we perceive direction in the real world. Our ears are listening to the timing differences between when the signals get to our ears. And these are very short time differences. Sound is going 700 miles an hour, and the time it takes to go from one ear to the other is about 7/10 of a 1/1000th of a second. So 0.7 milliseconds is the maximum time delay between your two ears. And if the time delay is in the range of 0.2 or 0.3 milliseconds to 0.6 or 7 milliseconds, we process that time delay as position. So the sound from the two speakers can be exactly the same loudness, but if it comes from the right speaker 0.3 milliseconds sooner than from the left speaker, we hear it as being on the right.
That is so cool. So you aren't going to be doing exactly those kind of demonstrations at the Odd Thursday presentation, but you are going to be doing something fascinating, showing us something without giving away anything.
Oh, I can demonstrate what I just described.
Oh, you can?
Yeah.
Okay. And then you're, without giving away any actual surprises of what you're specifically going to be showing us or letting us listen to, can you talk about the different categories of things that we will be experiencing during your presentation, besides this one?
Yeah, there was one I mentioned last week about the speech processor. I found a source on the internet where some neurophysiology researchers have made garbled speech out of synthesized sounds. And if you don't know what that sound is saying, it just doesn't sound like speech at all. You can't find speech in it, no matter how hard you try. But once you know what it's saying, then you can't not hear it as speech, no matter how hard you try. And I've got a couple of those recordings, which will, you know, be interesting. And I'll demonstrate the time delay effect for positioning sound and spatial perception. If I can arrange it in time, I'll try, probably for the second one, I'll bring a few sets of headphones and have some binaural recordings that people can listen to after the presentation and hear that spatiality.
You're going to have a long line of people wanting to do that.
I know, I could turn
it into
quite a project. That's why I'm not even completely sure, you know, what's going to happen at the second one. There's a lot of material, and there's a lot of very interesting little things to demonstrate. And another thing that's very central to the way we hear things is this thing I mentioned earlier, which is pattern recognition. And we're doing pattern recognition all the time. Pattern recognition is really, in a sense, simply recognizing things. The word recognize means that we've seen it before, and now we're somehow matching what we see now with what we saw before. And when they match, we say, aha. And interestingly, that aha is a tiny variation on the physiological signature that's been talked about as the aha response, and which we know from research is essentially comparable to what it's defined kind of as what a mathematician experiences subjectively when he suddenly sees the solution to a problem. or what anyone sees when they suddenly see a solution to a problem. It's really satisfying. There's this tremendous satisfaction. And they've found that there's another dimension of human experience where that same neurophysiological signature crops up, and that's when an infant is breastfeeding. So there's this experience of mother is at home and satisfaction and fulfillment and appreciation. Everything kind of fits together, and there's relief and resolution. And all of those things together represent the aha response. And any recognition experience is, to some degree, a reflection of that aha response. In other words, there's a little fiber of bliss in every experience of recognition.
This is so cool because I'm trying to learn French right now. Mm-hmm. And all that you just said about pattern recognition and about this aha experience is absolutely true for learning a foreign language. It's like it takes a number of repetitions of the same word or figure of speech or, you know, tense of a verb or something like that before that pattern is automatically recognized when you're listening to, you know. So what determines why, like I have a nephew who is amazing with languages. He became fluent, literally fluent in Japanese in a few months.
Wow.
And Russian as well. You know, he just has this knack of linguistic, you know, precision. So why is it easy for somebody like that? Does it have to do with that person just has a very refined sense of pattern recognition, and why is it difficult for other people?
Well, I think we'd have to look at probably, you know, substantial, you know, brain activity of different people. I mean, some people have a tremendous affinity for music or for language or for mathematics or for, you know, painting or for whatever. And that has to do with all sorts of complex relationships among the major, you know, operational units of the nervous system. So I wouldn't say that one person is better at pattern recognition.
Yeah, right. That's how I was saying. I don't think it's a matter of being better at pattern recognition. As somebody is been steeped.
Yeah, or the language processing centers are more highly developed.
Like in music or in mathematics.
Yeah. I mean,
someone who is a natural mathematician will be naturally seeing patterns mathematically, and other people will be musically or visually.
And there's another area, too, which has to do with simply with interest. If you're intrigued by a particular kind of thing, then you'll pick it up and be discriminating things in it much more rapidly than if you're not interested in it. So you could have very high math aptitude but not find math interesting. And then you wouldn't do well in math. You'd do okay, you know, but you wouldn't pursue it. Yeah. If you pursue it, that's because consciously, you know, you like it and you want more. I would love to know a foreign language fluently. I would love to be able to play the piano fluently. But I wouldn't love to do either one of them well enough to put in the necessary time and effort required to achieve that. But if it's spontaneously delightful, then there's no effort involved, and it's just fun, and you do it without, I mean, somebody has to make you stop doing it. But pattern recognition is intriguing because it operates on different time scales. There are patterns within patterns within patterns. And the nervous system seems to have a particular kind of sensitivity to certain kinds of patterns according to their time frame. If you make a sound that's a very simple sound, like just a click, and then you make it again, and then you make it again, if they're evenly spaced, we'll hear that as rhythm. And we'll say there's a pattern to it. It's click, 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 click. And that pattern, although it's incredibly simplistic, is still, by definition, it's a rhythm. If you speed it up so that the clicks are so close together that you can't differentiate them as individual clicks, you begin to hear it as a buzz. And the buzz actually has a tone. It's a note on the scale. And you, instead of hearing it as clicks, you hear it as melody. And when the buzzes are closer together, it's a high note. And when they're farther apart, it's a low note. And it's the same clicks. They're just closer together, being recognized as a pattern by a different pattern recognition device somewhere in the nervous system. And if you start thinking in terms of melody, you have a pattern of notes, and then a little later, the same pattern of notes, and your short-term memory is involved in that pattern recognition, then it says, wait, I heard that before. Cool. And there's a little bit of joy from recognizing it. Mm. Well, if you look at how music is actually assembled, traditional music, it's a sequence of little patterns and larger patterns, chord structures repeating, melodic things repeating. Maybe one instrument in an orchestra is repeating something exactly while the other instruments are doing something different but related. And that gives you the opportunity to hear these patterns in dozens of different ways all at the same time. And I think that's why we find music so extremely attractive.
Now, is this also true for the other senses? Because I was just thinking about the experience people have of going into art galleries and how they tend to get more excited seeing something that they've seen pictures of a zillion times, like
Absolutely. The
Mona Lisa,
sure.
than seeing a work of art that's brand new and is even of an art form that they've never even heard
yeah.
or seen before. And it's like, they just don't get it.
Well, there's always the problem of not recognizing any pattern
right.
in what's being presented, although the artist himself is obviously seeing all kinds of patterns in
yeah.
it. And so we have this moment of where the audience has to be awakened to new patterns, and that's a whole new school of art.
Yeah. Right.
I mean, I'm experiencing that with the show we have here at Icon Gallery right
sure.
now, is that people are coming in this audience that have never seen this type of work before. And they're basically saying, I don't see any patterns here. I'm not getting any satisfaction. There's no aha happening for
me. Exactly, yeah.
And, but you know what? These same people, I think, are looking at Jackson Pollock reproductions today, probably mostly, mm-hmm. and seeing art.
Right.
Because it's over the last 50 years, those things which were not, no one could get inside the patterning that Jackson Pollock was so inside, have now been able to get inside it as rhythms and patterns,
yeah.
and it's also recognizable as art, so we can also feel comfortable about liking
yeah.
it.
Yeah. Well, I'll never forget when I was, I guess I was a freshman in college, and I had heard Indian music, and it was nice, it was relaxing, and I could sit quietly when it was playing and, you know, not mind, but I didn't really get it. I had no idea what they were doing. It seemed like a long runs of arbitrary notes that never did anything with a structure to it. And one day someone introduced me to a recording called East Meets West, which is Yehudi Menuhin, a phenomenally skillful violinist, and Ravi Shankar playing together. And what they did in the structure of several of the pieces that they performed, which are utterly brilliant, and I can't recommend the record highly enough, what they were often doing was repeating each other's phrases. So it was like someone saying something in Sanskrit and someone saying it again in English. And then he would say something else in Sanskrit and the other person would say that thing in English. And you could start to see that this is going someplace. Well, of course, it was music. It was nonverbal. And I couldn't differentiate the subtleties of the sitar well enough to understand what he was doing with all those fast notes. But when I heard the exact same notes on Yehudi Menuhin's violin, I could relate to it easily because it was a familiar instrument. And then I saw the structure of the raga, and I thought, this is utterly fascinating. And it was wonderful. And I suddenly understood at least something basic about, you know, how Indian music works and how ragas work. And from then on, I enjoyed listening to them on a whole different level.
One of my most interesting experiences is around music, because I think music is really an experience of pattern recognition.
Yes, it's an orgy of pattern recognition.
references to trees and birds and various things in visual art we might have, or in storytelling.
Yeah.
It's just plain sitting there recognizing patterns sonically. I've always had the experience of hearing a new song, and you hear it the first time, and you just sort of like take in the surface level of the thing. You hear it, and it's like after you've heard it about 10 times, you're like in love with it.
Right.
But you can't have that. It seems like you can't have that experience first thing. Now, maybe musicians can, but I don't know.
I think the artist himself is in a place. Yeah.
And he's recognizing all these patterns and playing with them.
Yeah.
And you just have to like have enough time to sort of get into his place.
Well, that's
with
a key point, that it takes time, and pattern recognition requires time. And that's what I find so exciting about Jim Shrosbury's show, because it really does require time. And if you walk into Icon Gallery and look at Jim's sculptures on the wall, and you just look at them and then walk out, you won't have any idea what he's doing. You'll think, well, they aren't anything. I don't know why he did that. And what it requires almost is a kind of faith that the artist is not crazy, and that the Icon Gallery curator is not crazy, and he put these things on the wall because they're worth looking at. If they are worth looking at, then that raises a question of why. And you have to stand there and look at the thing and say, why on earth does someone think this is worth looking at a second time? And if you spend time with them, you can begin to get it. If you don't spend time with them, you definitely won't get it. So it's a great opportunity to sort of see that phenomenon at work in the visual arts.
We have 1 minute left. You made me think of nostalgia this whole, because many times you can have like some very beautiful inner reaction to some song you hear on the radio that you used to listen to a lot back 30 years ago, and you're feeling really good and singing along with it, and all of a sudden you realize you never really liked it back then. But because it's like this association with something that was familiar, you're feeling as if you really like it now.
Well, now we're talking about when we see the car, a car that was the same car driven by our first love.
Right.
Right.
We love the car.
Well, I hope this will entice people to come to Icon on November 1st too. But October 18th should be tomorrow if this show airs on the right day.
You've been listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.